You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Well, good morning, gardening folks, flower fanciers and plant lovers. You have tuned in to the 3CR Gardening Show. Happy Sunday to those of you who are tuning in live, and a big hello to those of you who get your gardening show goodness via the podcast. My name is Chloe Thompson from Been There, Dug That, and I am super excited to be here today chatting all things gardening with you. And in the studio with me today, I have two wonderful guests, Greg Balderston. Welcome, Greg.
Good morning.
Lovely to have you here. You've come down from your lovely tree paradise forest glade.
Yeah, up in Macedon Ranges. We had a beautiful thunderstorm last night, which I was happy to get after a few sort of hot, dry days.
Yes. Yeah, and humid as well. Was it humid up there for you?
Humid enough.
Yeah.
Anything over 23 is a bit hot for me.
It's a bit extreme. Yeah.
Like the cold weather. So, and as far as that goes, it's been a really good season, really, because I don't even think we've had a day over 30.
Yeah.
We might have reached 30 this week and maybe one a couple of weeks ago, but
yeah.
Most of the temperatures have been around the 23, 24 mark, you know, all the way up till now. So
yeah, it has been quite mild.
Yeah. Although, it's changing though.
I was going to say, have you seen next week?
So yeah, not looking forward to that. But yeah, it was nice to have, after a couple of hotter, drier days, a bit of heavy rainfall and bit of moisture.
So yeah.
it was nice to get that patched up, yeah.
I tell you what, I'm almost feeling like the rain, when it does come, I said to my husband the other day, it smells like Sydney, like it, because of that humidity.
Mm.
You know, it felt very Sydney-esque.
Yeah, right.
Because of the humidity and that build of the rain and then the rain and, yeah, it was very bizarre.
Yeah.
There's climate change for you.
Yeah.
Our second guest in the studio is Ben Brooker from Treasure Perennials. Welcome, Ben.
Yeah, good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Especially with all your pretty plants as well.
Yeah, got a few.
So. We will definitely touch on those. Yeah,
a couple of different unusual ones.
Yes, there are. There's a few that, you know, I sort of like, oh, that looks like a, and you've already told me that's in the same family as. So, yeah, we will definitely be touching on those. And Greg's brought in an armful of beautiful flowers as well. So thanks for running around and doing
that.
No
worries. Got some wet boots this morning after the rain. I thought I'd have a quick – and I haven't cut the grass. My mower's been broken.
Yeah.
And by the time I got back to the car with an armful of flowers, I was wet up to the knees. So I had to put the heater on halfway down to try and dry my lower half off, yeah.
And if anyone hears any little feet going tippity, 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 you've brought your little dog in.
Yeah, Trixie's here. She's sort of laid out on the cool floor at the moment, so but I'm sure she'll get up and tip-tap about at some point.
She's such a lovely girl. I love that she just comes everywhere and, yeah, wants to be part of it. It's very cute.
As long as she's involved, she's happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. I have one of those little shadows in my garden. Ben, have you been on since you did your Kiss the Ground?
No, I haven't been on, but we have texted in to thank everyone. And I think just to let people know basically what we actually raised for 3CR. So
yep.
It was just over $1,800. So
good.
Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. But it was a fun day though. Like it was, everyone was engaged.
Yeah.
And I think that was the beauty about it and also the design of it is we wanted to have people come to engage and go away feeling inspired, but also have the tools and that to sort of make a difference on what they're doing in their own garden, or look at things a little bit differently.
Yeah.
So instead of just going out to buy fertilizer or I have to kill that particular insect, you know, that's eating everything, it's, well, now people are looking at those sort of things a little bit differently. So
yeah. That's really good.
So, but no, it was actually a fun day.
Yeah. And were you saying off air earlier that there's more to come, or you're not sure? Oh, I've got to keep it shtum. Sorry, I should have asked beforehand. But anyway, stay tuned.
Yeah, we're talking about it. So yeah, Craig Castry and myself, it's something we'll probably talk about that in the new year. So
sure.
And maybe try and organise something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, good. So,
which will be.
You've planted the seed, shall we say.
Yeah, now I have.
to use that gardening analogy.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you were saying earlier as well about, you know, not spraying and, you know, not getting black spot and stuff on your roses that you said earlier off air.
Yeah.
You know, I've actually got one of the writers, actually the Hort editor for Organic Gardener magazine. He's just written an article all about, you know, just rethinking that approach to gardening where, you know, so often when people spot something wrong, the first thing is, where's the solution? Where's the spray? Where's the thing that I need to treat it? But as he says, as a horticulturist of God knows how many years, he virtually never sprays.
No.
So it's that rethinking process.
Yeah, I think you just if you have that sort of mindset, I think of you don't want to go into something with the same mindset on how it's actually created.
Mm.
So you're getting black spot because there's, you know, there's certain reasons why the plant's getting black spot. It's usually because the plant's not producing a lot of proteins or a lot of nutrients. It's not nutrient density in the actual plant. So the black spot's there to come in and take away the trash. It's there to pretty well try and kill the plants. And when the plant dies, falls to the ground, it's a new food source for the biology. It's in our soils. Mm. So like the fungus, the bacteria, you know, so they can sort of try and replicate and get this sort of quorum sensing, which is that sort of, you know, mass sort of different types of bacteria communicating on the same level, where if you have this imbalance of imbalance in nature, what they do is they'll separate. And then they will sort of tend to do different functions instead of working together.
Yeah.
They'll start to attacking different things to sort of break things down so that it can break down that organic matter or living tissue to organic matter to start feeding other biology, because what they're trying to do is they're trying to create a healthy biology in our soils. So they're
it's
creating
natural
their own
selection.
Yeah, so ecosystem
pressure.
Yeah. So I think if you sort of think in that sort of mindset, then when you see an infestation of insects or disease problems with the actual plants, I think if you think about, well, holistically, what was the root cause of that? Because there's also another root cause of that as well.
It's a chain reaction.
So, yeah, so if you start thinking in that sort of line, then and rectifying that issue, that will actually solve that issue at the end.
Yeah.
So you've got to sort of change your mindset, I find, instead of going into that approach where they're trying to kill something to create an organic matter to create a biome. Your mindset instantaneously goes to, I have to kill that problem to fix that problem. Well, that's not the case.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You go, Greg.
I was going to say too, often trying to kill the problem actually can
cause another problem.
The problem worse by, I've always say, nature abhors a vacuum. So if you create a vacuum space, which is exactly what you do when you spray herbicides and pesticides, especially a lot, the things that are going to fill those spaces aren't things that you really want, because they're pioneer species of whatever it is.
Yep.
And usually they deal with very harsh conditions, and they're quite sort of – they're not usually things you want to grow, right?
Yeah.
Whether they be fungi or bacteria or plants or whatever it is, you know, they're – those pioneering species are really, come in big numbers and are very, you know, the whole system needs to settle down again before you can start getting a bit more variety back in there.
Yeah,
so it's there for a reason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that
has
purpose,
a job.
Yeah, so that purpose is to create that biology back to a state where it's pretty well getting that diversity, and that's what it's all about.
Yeah,
you know. So
I was going to say, Matt, I've got two David Austin roses at my place, and both of them with their new foliage, it came through. You know, after winter, early spring, it came through covered in black spot. I put beautiful layer of homemade compost down on the bed, beautiful bush mulch on top of that. All this lush new foliage. Literally, the plant is now three times the size it was when it first woke up from spring. Not a bit of black spot on any of that new foliage. And all I have fed them is compost.
That's all you need.
Yeah. So the plant was almost like, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I needed.
Yeah.
You know.
But if you got, like, if you had the problems for years and years and years, you can actually also foliar spray with trace elements. Because then what you're getting the plant to do, it's actually finalizing a lot of the bulk nutrient that's like nitrogen, potassium and phosphorus, and then turning those into those complex form of proteins. And then when it produces those proteins, it will send those proteins and compounds down into the root system and then sort of releases these, what they call through the root exudates, which is this sticky substance, and that actually feeds the biology in the soils. So, and then that will sort of start recreating, you know, diversity as well, because the plant's actually producing everything what it should be doing, all the compounds and all the proteins that it needs to do. And then when it starts feeding the biology, then that biology then has the ability to go off and sort of collect nutrients out of like stone particles and sort of finer particles where the plant can't actually access that nutrient, but the microbe and the fungus can, and they'll put into a form that's actually in a plant available form, because in that root exudate, that plant will actually tell that bacteria, hey, I need molybdenum or iron or whatever. So they'll go off and solubilize that nutrient and then bring it back to the plant. That plant will give that a protein or an amino acid or carbon, you know, whatever that bacteria needs. But in return, that bacteria will give that plant it actually nutrient that it actually needs.
So cool.
So you need to actually have this balance. I think nutrient in actual plant is very important, but also more important, you've got to have that biology in our soils and that diversity of the biology, because that's what's going to create the plant to fight off any of those sort of pathogens like black spot, powdery mildew, because they're still present, but you'll find is this quorum sensing where they're all collaborating together. So they're actually functioning in this different sort of formation. There is a communication with each other that they will, instead of attacking and killing the living tissue, they will actually feed that living tissue. It's very simple, but I think it's that mindset of thinking about things a little bit differently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a whole little world going on that we can't see.
Yeah.
Well, look, people are up and early this morning. We have a text message in already. Rose in Thornbury says, good morning, crew. I'm wondering if you could cover fruit fly, as in what fruits they target, when to cover and how important it is. Also, appropriate netting to keep them out. It's pretty nuts, though, that orchards aren't protected and seem to be breeding fruit fly while growing fruit. Thanks, says Rose. Yes, it's definitely Queensland fruit fly is what Rose referring to. And, yes, don't be fooled by the name. It's definitely down in – you'd be Darabin, and it's definitely down in the Melbourne suburbs. Is it up in Macedon or is it still a little bit too cold?
I don't know that much about them, though.
Your way, Ben?
No, I haven't. No. Yeah.
I'm out in Hurstbridge, and I haven't had it in my garden, but my parents who live like 10 minutes away have had it. And Rose, it literally will go in any fruit. And by fruit, we are also referring to tomatoes, capsicums, chilies, eggplants, anything that has a fruiting body. So the little flies, the females will lay their eggs into any fruit. And the best time to put the covers or the nets on is once the fruit is actually formed. So once the fruit has set and you can see little baby fruit, that means pollination's happened and you don't need to worry about pollination being initiated by bees or wind pollination or anything. So long as you can see baby fruit, then you can start covering them up. My fruit trees are all dwarf trees and they're all in pots. So I use individual mesh bags, fine mesh bags, and I just put them over the little fruit clusters. And I find that works a treat. I harvested, and I'm making like a big bowl shape with my hands. I harvested this many cherries this year from my cherry tree. The bags worked a treat. But otherwise, yes, you can use insect-proof netting Just make sure that it's wildlife safe, insect proof netting. And from memory, the hole size needs to be 2 millimetres for insect proof.
There is specific netting for it. So.
There is. There's a difference between wildlife netting and insect netting.
What's the girl that comes on here that does the...
Bron.
Bron.
Yeah.
So she's part of an organisation that is to find out... they would give you all the information you really need as well. So I don't know. Yeah, how would you get in contact with them?
I'm going to have to look it up now. But do you know what, Rose? Weirdly, you're going to hear my voice again. If you go and search Darebin, Queensland fruit fly, I made a video for the Darebin City Council all about how to manage fruit fly in your garden. And ironically, you're actually in Darebin. So if you search Darebin, Queensland fruit fly, my mug and my voice will come up on a video on YouTube, and I explain all about it in that, including baiting, using traps, making traps, using the right nets and things like that. So, and in that video is a link back to Bron's network.
Oh, good. Yeah, because also I think because things will need netting different times, and then and like tomatoes, it'd probably be a bit difficult too, because sometimes the tomatoes will set fruit early and then they're still producing flowers as they're growing. And so you can't sort of just cover it because they still need to be pollinated.
Yep.
So you still need to allow other insects in, or unless you want to get in there and pollinate it yourself.
Well, that's where the bags are handy with tomatoes, rather than netting the whole plant.
Yeah.
You know, you literally just bag the little, mental blank. The green bit where all the tomatoes come off.
Yep.
You know what I'm referring to. You just literally net that little section.
Yeah.
And that's why they're handy. They're also, I find, they just look a bit nicer having the little bags rather than having ghosts of nets all over the backyard.
Yeah. I'm going to do that anyway because of the birds.
Oh, right. Well, the mesh bags keep the birds out as well, because I get the king parrots flying in. And
I've had rats chew through those little mesh bags.
Really?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't had that yet.
I had a persimmon that I was trying to get some fruit off.
Yep.
And it had all the little bags all over it, and they kept them away for a while, but then they got desperate, so they just...
Bugger.
They're almost... It was like they were grabbing the fruit through the mesh bag and then just chewing it up and squeezing all the juice out of it.
No way.
'Cause until they could actually get through the bag, they were using it like a
juicer.
A juicer, yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
You've taken all the pips out for me, thank you.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. No worries. I know all about it. Thanks, Chloe. Trying to get the word out. Not a problem. I'm hoping that is helpful, Rose, and good luck with the season. The commercial orchards definitely do things like Queensland fruit fly traps and things like that, and baiting programs. But obviously, if they don't necessarily insect net their orchards, it can be pretty tricky.
Yeah, but I think hygiene too. So any fruit that falls to the ground, you 100%. Pick it up, get rid of it.
Yeah.
But if it goes in the compost, I think, you put it in the compost but bury it. That's usually the best way.
Well, even put it in the compost, but do it in the compost after you've perhaps solarized it or boiled it. So they say boil it for 10 minutes and then you can put it in the compost. You know, solarize it for a good couple of days in the sun. So sit it out in a black plastic bag or like a Tupperware container, solarize it. And then compost it, because then you know that you've 100% killed the larvae as well.
Which is important.
Yeah.
You know, that second cycle.
And you know what the other big transporter of it is? Obviously, fruit trees in suburbia, but when people pick their fruit and then they take it to like their local free food hub. Do you have one of those in your neighbourhood?
We've got
one in Hurstbridge, where people share seedlings and free food and preserves and, empty jars and things like that. Mm. And, all it takes is for someone to pick their apricots and then they take them to this free food hub. They're infested with fruit fly.
Mm, there you go.
And then the person brings them home, cuts them open, goes, what are those squirmy things? I'll better chuck those in the compost, chucks them in the compost. And bingo, they've just migrated it around. So, we always say to people, if you are wanting to, put excess produce into one of those free food type of places, make sure you cut open a few to check if you haven't got Queensland fruit fly. Because from the outside, the fruit can look perfectly fine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not until you cut open and see that the insides of it are moving.
We'll take a bite of it.
It's got extra protein.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Susie in the producer, Susie, has called in the Inner North Council has rung into 3CR about a net swapping program. We're not sure which Inner North Council. So you can swap your nets if you had the wrong type of netting. Oh, that's clever. Yeah, because you can't. Oh, Burundara, Yara. Good. Thanks, producer girls in the studio. Mary Beck. So, yeah, it's now illegal to sell the larger netting, the non-wildlife safe. Essentially, with netting, if you can get your finger through it, the hole, then it's not wildlife safe. So you can't get your finger. It needs to be, I think it's 5 mils or less and 2 mils or less for insect proof. Yeah, so good people make sure they're doing the right thing and be amazing. Fantastic. Let's talk about some pretty things. Greg.
So I bought in pretty much the only thing that's really flowering in the garden at the moment. The hydrangeas are just starting to colour up. Mm-hmm. And also at Forest Glade, Heidis are one of the, the big five, I guess. We've got, heaps of roadies and heaps of maples and heaps of Heidis.
Yep.
And the roadies are pretty much finished up at Forest Glade, but the Heidis are just starting to come out and flower and colour up.
Mm-hmm.
So I just grabbed a couple. They're not really anything particularly special at home anymore, but there's one called Aisha, which I always think looks like popcorn.
It does look like popcorn.
I've never fully figured out if I actually like it or not, or if it's just because I've known it since I was a little kid and... they can be really pretty. This one's quite fresh. It's growing near some, I live in an acidic, soil. I've got acidic soil.
Mm-hmm.
And usually that means your Heidis are going to be blue.
Mm-hmm.
This one's quite close to the house. And I think the lime leaching out of the concrete, and the mortar from the bricks. It's funny though, that there's another Aisha right beside it, which is blue.
Oh.
So I've got a blue and a pink one sort of together. The florets, instead of having flat sepals, mm-hmm. They're curled up sort of around the edges and they look a little bit like popcorn.
They do, yeah, a pinky-tinged popcorn.
And it's also a very old variety. It's probably not hybridised as much as like a seedling sport that someone mm-hmm. found and thought, oh, that looks interesting, I'll grow that.
Yeah.
It's a hydrangea maritima.
Okay.
The natural species of those usually goes on cliffs on seaside in Japan.
Really?
And it's a lace cap.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of – so some of the really old varieties that you see in very old gardens in Australia are often these Heidis that were seed sports or the first sort of generation of seedlings that – plant collectors in the 1800s brought back to Europe
mm-hmm.
and just started when they first started playing with Heidis.
Yep.
So it's one of those older varieties. I've also bought in one called Nightingale, which is a German hybrid. Again, this is right next to my concrete water tank, so it's more on the pinkish side, this one.
Mm-hmm.
But it was bred to be a blue one. Often Heidis are bred for a certain colour, but obviously if it was bred to be blue and you've got it in alkaline soil, it's not going to be blue.
Mm.
This one was bred to be a really dark, deep blue. But the lime washing out of the concrete tanks, it gives it a sort of a purpley colour, but it's still quite a beautiful dark colour. It's just starting to colour up now. It gets a bit darker than that.
Yep.
But it's not a full flower like the other ones, is it?
No, this is a lace cap or a teller, I think they call them. But, it's like a lace cap hydrangea nightingale. It's quite strong flowering, strong little bush, usually a strong colour. So acidic soil will be a deep, dark blue, and in the alkaline soil it's sort of a purpley pink colour.
Mm-hmm.
This one, I have no idea what the name of this is. A lot of the old, they've been breeding Heidis for about, 150, 200 years or something. I think there's somewhere, it's probably well over this now, but about 5,000 hybrids.
Whoa.
At some point. In Australia, they used to be a bit easier to remember because we got less of those here because they were usually bred in places like Germany and France and Britain. So I've got no idea what this one's called. But it's a nice, it's one of the nice ones. But they're still hybridizing these things, so you can get bicolored florets, ones that have got like a, let's say a purple floret with a white edge, or different color variations like that. I've noticed too that they've started breeding them with multicolored stems and like different colored leaves, as in you might get a deep burgundy leaf with lighter green veinings.
That one's got margins. Well, I like the spiky margins on that one's leaves.
Yeah.
Really, really deep lobes. But then, yeah, it's got burgundy.
Yeah, so I think that's more sun on this one, but some of them are actually like almost burgundy leaves with lighter green veins, dark stems, and then whatever the flower does. But I like species ones better. And there are some absolutely stunning species hydrangeas, especially if you like smaller, daintier ones, the ones from Japan. So hydrangea japonica and hydrangea serrata, which is where the genetic the genes for these bigger hybrids came from originally. So you've got the species ones would have been hydrangea maritima and japonica and serrata and a few of the others, and they've used those crossbreeding those to make the modern Macrophylla hybrids. Yeah, the species ones for me, though, there's absolutely stunning ones. As I say, you've got the little dainty lace caps and things from Japan. You get some of the hydrangea aspera from Asia, from mainland China and places like that. They're basically trees. You know, they'll get up to 5, 6, 7 metres tall, and some of them have flowers 30 or 40 centimetres across, big lace cap flowers. There's also some hydrangeas from the Americas. Hydrangea quercifolia is one of those.
That's one of my favourites.
This is a hybrid, but because it's a bit closer to species and it's such a stunning plant, it's probably one of my favourite hydrangeas.
That flower spike is huge. So, it's like 40 centimetres long?
Yeah. And they occasionally get a little bit bigger than this too.
Whoa.
So this is hydrangea quercifolia snowflake. It isn't evergreen. It's still deciduous, but it holds onto its leaves so long that it's almost evergreen.
Ah, okay.
But the bonus with that is you get beautiful oak leaves on it throughout the season, throughout the warmer months. And then somewhere in autumn going into winter, the leaves start to go really deep, dark burgundies and plums and purples and with the occasional flecks of yellow and bright red through them. Beautiful foliage. The flowers, they usually start November, early December, and it will have flowers coming on it all the way through until autumn. And also the flowers tend to, as long as they're not in too much hot sun and they're not getting burnt, hot afternoon sun and hot winds, the flowers seem to persist for quite a long while too. So the florets at the moment on these fresh ones are quite light whitish green. With age, they sort of green off a little bit and go a bit harder like Heidi's tend to do. But they look great for months and months and months, the quercifolias. And they're also, they can handle a lot more sun. And once they're established, they don't need that much water. They're actually quite water. So I've got this on the east-facing side of the front of my house. So it's in full sun up until about midday, even in summer. It rarely burns. I only water them maybe a couple of times a year after we've had a few weeks of no rain and hot weather, and then they'll need a bit of a water. But other than that, they're very tough, hardy, beautiful plants.
Because you'd sort of think because of the big leaf that they would sort of suck a lot of water, but they don't.
No, they don't.
We're the same at home with ours. I mean, we've got it on the south side of the house and I don't even water it. There's no supplementing watering or anything. And they're perfect.
And most of the American species seem to be quite water, comparative to the Asian species. They're quite good at not needing as much water.
Too much. They're the first ones that'll let you know that the garden needs watering. So,
And the thing is too, with the macrophyllas from coming from somewhere like Japan or China. A lot of those Heidis, where they come from, it's not that they're getting excessive amounts of rainfall, it's that the air's more humid. I think we have hot, dry down here where they're from. I mean, they don't like the hot so much, but if it is hot, it's humid as well. So that, and we don't have that. We have this sort of hot, dry, usually.
Usually, yeah.
we have this sort of hot, dry.
But if you get that dew in the morning, so because the plants, the leaf is designed to drink that moisture, it's on the leaf in the morning as well. So, but you sort of need to have a little bit of humidity around as well for the plant to open up its pores and suck in that moisture.
Yeah. And Heidi's usually bounce back pretty well. If you've got a really hot, dry year and your Heidi's are struggling all the time, it's just a bad year for them.
Yeah.
That's as bad as it gets. They're actually quite hardy in what they can survive. They just won't look good that year. They'll just be a bit rough that year.
Yeah. That's,
and that happens with most plants if they're, most plants have good and bad years, and bad years for the hybrid Heidis are hot, dry years, like with no humidity and very little rainfall. It doesn't necessarily mean that they will die. It just means that they won't have a great season. The leaves will be smaller. The flowers will probably get burnt off before they fully colour. And, you give them a bit of a haircut and, spray them with sea salt a few times, and next year away they go and they come good again.
Yeah. I've got one hydrangea in my garden, paniculata. I think it's Rouge Diamond.
Yeah.
I think that's what it's called. Rouge something anyway. But its flowers start off sort of a very soft pink, almost white.
Yep.
And then as the season progresses, they turn like this deep, moody red.
Yep.
Burgundy. And it's in a spot that I would say it was full sun. And if anything, it actually gets more afternoon sun than morning sun.
Right.
So I've always found the paniculatas in particular very sun hardy. Which are
another American, one of the American species, they've hybridized them a lot too, so you can sort of pick through if you want a particular thing for them. Some are quite green and sort of apple, similar colours to the Quercifolia, sort of that whitish green, apple green sort of colour.
Yeah.
And then, as you say, some of the paniculatas have these beautiful reds, especially when the flowers get older and a bit weathered. You get where droplets of water have sat on them and the sun shone through them. You get these spots all over, speckles over them. It's where the moisture's been sitting and almost like a lens from the sunlight.
Burning
little holes in the petals, but they turn red instead of brown or, well, if they're too bad, they'll go brown. But, you get these beautiful.
That can happen with these hydrangeas as well. So I've seen that with them.
Yeah.
So if you do see it, it's not disease. Just let it
go.
It's just another feature.
The other thing, especially with hybrid Heidis, is that what we call autumn colour. So you get the, the ones I've bought in are mainly pinks. So you get these beautiful, fresh, crisp, single sort of pink, crisp colours when they first come out. And after a while, when they've seen a little bit of weather and they've been around for a couple of months, you start getting speckles on them. And then all of a sudden in autumn, you've got this whole new shrub. You know, it might have been, a soft blue when it first flowered earlier in the season, and now all of a sudden it's got these beautiful deep greens and burgundies through it. You get this double thing of bright summer colours, and then as you go into autumn, you get these beautiful autumn colours through the flower heads as well. And again, some of the species ones are, there's an old variety called Grayswood, which is a lace cap. It's one of those Heidis I was talking about before, where the people that first started, the Europeans that first started collecting them from Asia in the 1800s, bought these things back. So this one calls Grayswood. It's a little white lace cap flower, very dainty.
Pretty.
Beautiful foliage, but as the flowers get older, the white petals turn deep scarlet red.
Ooh.
And turn upside down. So they sort of they drop down and face down, but the backs of them turn bright scarlet red.
Wow.
So I like subtle things like that.
Yeah. You know where there's a beautiful display of the Quercifolias? The NGV, you know, when you walk through, like you're at the ground level where you walk in, and if you keep walking and you walk out into the courtyard, across the very back wall of the courtyard, sort of like opposite the sliding door and opposite the little cafe out there, a whole back wall of the hydrangea Quercifolias. And they're stunning when they're in flower.
Yeah.
Absolutely pretty. Yeah. Really, whoa.
And they're really easy to propagate. And, as I say, the biggest downside is for the tougher species, getting them established as far as water goes. And obviously if you're in really hot, dry and you've got water problems, Heidi's probably aren't the best option. Yeah.
Yeah. But they add good colour as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think, you know, just that sort of start of summer colouring. I mean, because there's such a large flower and you do get an abundance of flowers on them. But there's so many, like when you walk into nurseries now, I mean, and they've got a collection of hydrangeas and so many new species are coming in online, you know, just, you know, different colours. I mean, we went into a nursery just the other day and there was that real burgundy, sort of deep red, burgundy Nelly sort of flowering variety. And those ones will sort of stay true to colour. So it doesn't matter what your pH is.
Yeah.
So they'll always stay that traditional whatever colour it is.
Whatever colour it is, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing with quercifolias and paniculatas too. They don't care about your pH.
No.
It's mainly the ones that have their DNA sort of linked to some of the those Japanese species.
Yeah.
That they've been bred from, and like the white ones don't change with pH.
No, they will always be white.
Yeah. If you look carefully, so my favourite white ones are a French hybrid called Madame Emile Moulier, which is...
That's a cool name.
Probably from the 1880s or 1870s or something like that. And if you've got it in an acidic soil, which is the soil I grew up with these Heidis, they're perfectly pure white. But if you look carefully at the so the big florets you see in a hydrangea are actually infertile. The sepals are there's no pollen produced and there's no stigma or anything like that working on those. But if you dig down in the head of a hydrangea, you'll see these other flowers underneath that don't have the sepals. They're just these little tiny. So the word hydrangea means water vessel. And it refers to the seed pods and the flowers, which look like little amphora, you know, the Greek wine and oil vessels used to make. They're sort of slightly wider at the top with a shoulder. And then you can't stand them up. They've got this very small, thin base.
Mm.
So that's where the term hydrangea comes from.
Huh.
And if you dig underneath the big showy petals, you get these little flowers with no petals, and they're the fertile ones. And that's what, when you look at a lace cap flower, the big petals are around the outside. It's the little fluffy flowers on the inside that haven't got the petals. That's the they're the fertile flowers. So those will change colour. So if you've got a white hydrangea in acidic soil and you dig down, you'll see these little tiny blue fertile flowers, but if it's in alkaline soil, still look perfectly white, but if you dig down, they'll be slightly pink.
Have you seen how florists will rehydrate, like, mop-top hydrangea heads?
No, I don't.
Like, florists, if they're using mop-top hydrangeas, they can obviously be princesses and go a bit droopy. Mm. If they want to rehydrate them, they'll get a bucket and put dunk the flower heads in the bucket, leave them there for like half an hour, hour, and come back to them and the mop head is, back to...
That's that humidity we were talking about earlier, I think. Yeah, they do respond well to that.
Yeah.
You can also, with white, especially the lighter coloured hydrangeas, I, as a kid I tried it a couple of times, you can put food dye in the water.
I remember doing
that. And you get a white hydrangea with the blue veining through it, which... Yeah, it's fun.
Fun. Oh, goodness. All right, listeners, we're well past 8 o'clock now. You have tuned into the 3CR Gardening Show. My name is Chloe Thompson, and in the studio with me today are Greg Balderston and Ben Brooker. We would love to invite you, our listeners, to join in. So if you have a gardening question or a comment, we would love to hear from you. You can call us for a chat on air on 94190155. That's 94190155. Or you can send us a text message on 0488 809 855. Just remember, we can't see photos on text message, but you're welcome to text any comment or question in. If you do need to send us a photo, though, you can email it to us at 3cr.gardening@gmail.com, and we will answer it on another show. We have had a message come in from David. Hi, Chloe, Greg and Ben. Loving the program. Could I get your advice on best application of biochar for the garden? I've purchased 200 litres. I was going to broadfork it in. I'm on half an acre in Upway. Thanks, David. Over to you, Ben.
You just really just sort of distribute it over where you're actually needing it, because it's what it's going to do. It's really going to stimulate biology.
Mm.
And you think about it, it's not an actual fertilizer.
Yeah.
As such, it's that sort of what you call biostimulants. It's what it's doing. It's actually going to stimulate that biology to help sort of start breaking down different sort of nutrient in the soils. So I think it's just a matter of applying it. So, and it's one of those things that you can't really sort of overdo it.
Okay.
But you've got to be careful that if you do put a lot down, you are wasting a lot too, because the biology that's there can only feed on a certain amount of it.
Yep.
So if you do small amounts but more frequently, then it's a lot more beneficial. So
just sprinkle it on like it's...
Yeah, just sprinkle it on. That's all you need to do. So
would it be better to do it like pre-rain event?
Doesn't really matter?
No. Okay. So it can sit on the surface and it's not going
to... No. It is best to, I think, once you actually do apply, if you add a little bit of moisture to it as well, and that will sort of let it settle, and the biology that is there will hopefully start feeding on it as well. But I think the trick is you always got to make sure you've got your soil covered as well, because that's the mistake a lot of people make. They think if they've got this bare soil, they'll apply these biostimulants. But realistically, you actually don't really have the biology there because...
There's no roots.
Well, there's no roots, but also they've been cooked because the sunlight that's actually penetrating onto that soil is actually cooking them. So they're actually either going to go deep or they're going to scatter to where soil is actually covered. So it's very crucial to have it covered and having actually also diversity in different plants as well, because the different root structures will contain like different depths. So they will go either further down or they're more sort of lateral shooting along the surface. So they're sort of feeding on different nutrients and sort of breaking the soil up at different levels as well and even different thicknesses. But they're covering the soil, but then when they actually start putting those root exudates into the soil, they're doing different root exudates. So there's different sort of proteins and sugars they're actually putting back into the soil to feed that bacteria as well. But having that biostimulant of the biochar just makes them work a lot better as well. So they will actually, they will solubilize nutrient a lot better.
Mm.
So they become a lot more active.
Well, so, David, it sounds like your soil and your garden is about to burst with 200 litres of biochar. So, and I mean, if you don't need to broadfork it over half an acre, that's going to save you back as well. So just a little bit of fertiliser fairy, as I like to call it at my place, even if it's just compost. I often do it right before the rain.
But another good thing is if you actually, if you are spraying it, mix a bit of fulvic acid with it as well.
Oh, so 200 litres, you reckon he's got it in liquid form?
You could have it in liquid form, yeah. So,
right.
So if you add a bit of, fulvic acid, even molasses. Molasses is another really good food source because it's actually, even though you're sending that off as a biostimulant, you're actually also adding another food source as well. Like, for instance, with molasses is that sort of carbon sort of base and a lot of sugars
and hydrates
and also you've got things like magnesium and it's full of iron as well. So
that's because it's low, it's not very refined in the sugar process. It's one of the first things that comes off
sugarcane
when they refine sugar.
Yeah, but you can't buy it from the supermarket because that has been refined.
No,
as well.
You need to go to a stock feed.
Yeah, and buy it like a 20 liter. It could cost you like $50.
Okay.
Where if you go to the supermarket, you get a little like 300 grams, and it's going to cost you like $10 or whatever it is. So, I used to remember when I was a kid, my grandfather used to have 200 litre drums of it and I'd be sticking my hand in there and eating the molasses.
Yummy tar.
That's it. But that's that food source. And, so you're basically sending everything off running with basically a lunchbox, really.
We've got a call in here from Anne in Northcote. You there, Anne? Hello.
Good morning.
You wanted to ask Ben about the application rate and frequency of lactobacillus, is that correct?
Yeah, I do. It rained a lot this year and I did use it, but did it all wash away? And how often, Ben, do you think it's beneficial to apply? I've got clay kind of soil in Northcote, obviously, so does it change?
No, it is a living bacteria, so, and it's a bacteria that doesn't live for long. It only lives for a couple of days. So the best way I always find, it's like what I was just talking about before, if you send it off with a food source, when it's actually applied to the soil, even though it's actually breaking down organic matter, but having that sort of biostimulant like a molasses or a fulvic acid, because that's actually a food source, they'll start replicating in the soil straight away as well. So you, instead of just lasting for a couple of days, it'll last for maybe a couple of weeks in the soil. Even if it rains, it's not really going to leach out of the soil because it is a bacteria. They'll cling on to certain aggregates in the soil or they'll cling on to root systems. So they're not going to leach through your soil, but they will die out eventually. So, look, I use it a fair bit. Like, I scatter it around as much as I can, but I don't like to concentrate on just on one species because I'm a big believer in having diversity in our plants, but also diversity in the bacteria, the biology, because having that diversity, you have this sort of balance in nature, basically, where things start to work really well together. So things will look better. They'll, you know, be able to withstand, you know, hot, dry conditions a lot better. When it does start to really dry out, having that good diversity of biology with the lactobacillus, with all these other different types of bacteria, it'll hang on to that moisture. So that moisture then would be fed to the plant at a later date. Even you might think it's actually really dry, but there is still a form of moisture there that has the ability to feed the plant. So, look, it's important, to put those biostimulants and even bacteria in our soils, but do it in small doses instead of sort of more frequently. So instead of just doing one big dose and then leaving it for 6 weeks or whatever, I would actually sort of distribute over maybe once a week or something like that, and just do a sort of light sort of solution of maybe 100 mils to every, say, 10 litres or 9 litres of water, which is a watering can, and then just doing that either once a week or even once a fortnight.
Mm.
Yeah, so, and that way you're actually still having this sort of this bacteria that's breaking down organic matter faster than what a lot of the other bacteria do. And when they die off, the other bacteria will feed on the lactobacillus, which they've already solubilized that nutrient, and then that other bacteria will feed the actual plant. So it's speeding up a process of breaking down nutrients. Mm. So,
yeah. Does that help at all, Anne?
I think so. You can't really overdo the frequency as long as you spread it around and keep it mild.
Yeah, that sounds like the message, yeah.
Like you don't do it once a season or that's a bit too infrequent. You kind of just keep doing it.
Yeah, keep doing it, but just in smaller doses. Mm. And that's, I find, it's a much more beneficial way of doing things because you're not wasting it either.
Mm.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Sorry, is it foliar or soil applied? It's both, isn't it, really?
Yeah, you can do both. Probably more soil with that one because it needs to have that sort of organic matter to feed off, because lactobacillus is a bacteria that will feed off sort of dying tissue. If you put it on a leaf, it sort of will probably, any decaying tissue, like any cells that it's actually breaking down on a leaf, it'll probably feed off that. It's not going to affect the plant. But, yeah, I don't think it's really necessary to spray the plant. Put it into the soil.
As much as you can, yeah.
But then also keep your soil covered.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the
most. Always. Yeah. Always keep your soil covered, whether it's plants
very
or mulch
helpful.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Anne.
Thank you.
Good luck. Bye. Fantastic. We have had a text message in from Wendy in Wanni. I'm not sure where that is. Wendy says, hi panel, how do you apply molasses? How do you normally apply it?
So when I put like a nutrient down, so if I'm specifically putting down like trace elements, I'll add like a fulvic acid or a molasses to it, because that's going to stimulate that biology, because if you think about it, biology is everywhere. Like, there's bacteria all over your plant. There's all even funguses all over your plant as well. You just can't see it. But even in the soil, it's just like you have this.
There's more.
There's even more.
Like there's more surface area.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So when you think about one teaspoon of healthy soil, there's like 8 billion microbes in there. Then you've got your fungi.
Yeah.
Then you have the mitochondria. So it just this huge amount of sort of diversity of life. But look, when you add, you mix it up in a watering can or a spray packet, and you probably add, like, say for a 9-liter watering can, just 100 mils of molasses. That's all you need.
Give it a stir. Does it need to be warm water for it to dissolve?
It doesn't have to be warm water.
No.
Yeah, just stir it around. Yeah.
Okay.
And just apply it.
Yeah.
So just as a form as that biostimulant, but also it can help to chelate. Chelate, referring Latin, is claw.
Yeah.
So it can grab hold of that nutrient, the plant will be able to has the ability to drag it in and hold on to all those nutrients as well. So
good stuff.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for that, Ben. We've got a Heidi question on the line here for you, Greg. Let me see if I can get her on. Hello, Jane. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
You've got a question about hydrangeas.
I have, yes. And look, thank you for your fabulous discussion. I'm in Northern Victoria and my hydrangeas are in full bloom. They're wonderful. I have Annabelle's. And I find they're a lot leggier than the traditional hydrangeas that I've had before. And they're in full bloom now. And once they set their bloom, is that it for the season? Look, could I cut them back and will I get new ones? Or is that your full quota once they appear sort of in spring?
Yeah, I think if you cut the... firstly, the hydrangea Annabelle's hybrid from a species called Arborescens, which is ironic because you've just said, and I agree, they're one of the leggiest species, and arborescens means tree-like. So I'm not sure who came up with that name. But Annabelle's absolutely stunning. You can get beautiful big lime green, sort of pale whitish green flowers on them. I wouldn't cut them back during the season. I don't think you'll get enough growth on them to get any later flowers.
Is it possible she's not cutting them back enough in the winter?
Yeah.
Or is it wrong time of year and you're cutting them back?
Yeah. So the best time to cut them's when I think the best time to cut any Heidi's when the buds are starting to swell, sort of later in winter. So you let them go as long as possible before you prune them. For arborescents, though, often not pruning them at all, except maybe deadheading them so you can get rid of the old brown shriveled up flowers, not pruning them at all is probably the best thing. They don't really need, they only need pruning to try and keep them off a pathway or, trying to form them into something. The plant itself doesn't really need pruning. Except for maybe deadheading for aesthetic reasons.
Okay, right. I just thought they might be getting too tall and leggy and perhaps I need to prune them a bit harder, but possibly just let them go.
Yeah, no, I'd let them go. I say, only prune them if there's a good reason to prune them. They're not like the hybrid Heidi's where they particularly benefit from a prune. They probably, you'll get more flowers on them if you just let them go for a couple of seasons and deadhead them.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, good luck with that, Jane.
Thank you.
No worries. There you go. Very helpful.
So that might be the solution, is let it go for a couple of years, then prune it down. Then let it grow again for a couple of years and then prune it back
down
again.
That's a good thing for a lot of things that you sort of think about pruning or coppicing or pollarding is, letting them, especially if they're a new plant, of course, you don't want to heavily prune something you grew from cutting last year.
Yeah, yeah.
You sort of... Let them get their root system established a bit first before hacking into them. The arborescence will handle quite a heavy, brutal pruning, but it's just not something – they are really weird, wiry bushes. They're not the best-looking bushes, but the flowers, especially on Annabelle, are absolutely stunning. They're quite decent-sized.
Yeah, I just did a quick Google.
But I think if they're wiry and all that, I think you maybe need to look at it in a different form. Look at the beauty of how it's actually growing in intertwining.
So with something like arborescence, you would put it behind like a nice structural border plant that's up to 50 to 80 centimetres tall.
Okay.
This is a really bad example, but there are some arborescents at Forest Glade that are sitting behind daylilies and agapanthus.
Okay.
And they stop that thing, the arborescents from, the hydrangea arborescents from tumbling onto the path, or you're not looking at the structure of the plant, you're only looking at the top of the plant.
Yeah. It's a back of border plant.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
And you can have, you know, stuff growing up through it or around it, you know, some taller stuff behind it and some shorter stuff in front of it.
Mm.
But it's not, there's nothing structurally beautiful about it at all. It's not.
In the nicest possible way.
Even as a kid when I first came across arborescence, it was like, why is it tree-like? There's nothing tree-like about this at all. It's just this wiry sort of mass of spindly little shoots and with these nice, roundish, whitish green mop tops on it. Which is unusual for a species, especially one of the American. Okay. It's another American species. Yeah.
Yeah. The phone lines are running hot today. We have Helen from Richmond. Morning, Helen.
Oh, good morning. Look, I just wanted to see what the team knows about this Victorian Significant Tree Register. I've only just found out about it, and that if there is a tree on this register, you can actually need a permit to remove a tree.
Oh, okay.
Does anyone know anything about it? Oh, sorry, I'd better turn the radio down just a minute.
Does either of you know anything?
Well, yeah, there's quite a few registered trees up Mount Masson from different parts too. I think there's a couple in the National Trust and...
That's sure. Right.
Yeah.
That's correct,
I also know... So the property I grew up in had a couple of those.
Yes.
It was planted in the 1870s, and the people that bought the place just cut a few of them out, and I guess it's easier for some people just to apologise later rather than asking for permission. I don't think there's too much backlash for doing that, unfortunately. I don't know about the bureaucratic side of getting permits and things.
It sounds
them. I
like
just know that a lot of people don't really care and they'll just go and do something.
It sounds like it's managed by the local councils as well.
Actually, Stephen Ryan would be a good person to talk to. So if you ring...
Who would be...
Stephen Ryan. So if you ring Dicksonia Rare Plants, he's up in Mount Macedon, ask for Stephen.
He would know about this.
He would fill you right in the ins and outs of it all. And
that's great. I'll do that because, look, I'll just quickly give you the context. There is a plan at Melbourne University to put a pedestrian pathway through a garden.
Oh.
And I've discovered that that this garden has a number of significant trees on it. I've only just discovered that. There was a list. It's University House. It's a staff club. And it's a heritage house. And it's being refurbished. But it's got a west garden, and I have just discovered that there are a number of significant trees listed on this west garden, that most of which will be demolished for this pedestrian pathway. So I only just found out about the notion of a significant tree register. So, yeah.
Another person that knows a lot about this subject is Dr. Greg Moore. I'm not sure if he's still
teaches. And he's often on radio.
Yeah.
Hang on. Just a minute.
So Greg...
First of all, we've got Stephen Ryan.
Yep.
Yeah, I know.
So Stephen's got easy access and I'm sure he'd be quite useful.
He's on just a minute. He's in Dicksonian what?
Dicksonian Nursery.
How do you spell that? Dicksonian...
It's Dicksonia Rare Plants in Mount Macedon. It's
Dicksonian Rare Plants.
Dicksonia is Dicksonia. Rare Plants.
Rare Plants in Mount Macedon.
And he's in Mount Macedon. He's also obviously a frequent guest on the show here too.
Yes, I know.
And Greg Moore, Dr. Greg Moore.
Greg Moore, yep.
I remember listening to a lecture he did once many years ago on power companies hacking into trees and how, you know, solutions for that that still haven't come into practice and whatever. I would say he's probably the most interesting. He can talk about anything and it's interesting, but him talking about, you know, looking after our trees, whether they be indigenous trees, especially older ones, or ones that white people planted here when they came here that are also older and and have value. Greg Moore's probably, I would say, one of the best experts in Australia on that sort of subject.
And he often rings into ABC Talkback Radio. I feel like it's on a weekday I often hear him. But
do you have a contact for him?
No, unfortunately we don't. But his surname is Moore, M-O-O-R-E. And he was a lecturer at Burnley. I'm not sure if he still is, but you might be able to find him.
I'm sure he'd have some presence somewhere if you Googled his name.
LinkedIn or somewhere like that.
He'd have a presence somewhere online.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Hope that's helpful.
Yes, that's very, very helpful.
Oh, thanks, Helen.
Thank you.
Bye. Goodness, yeah, the significant tree register. That was a bit of good sleuthing on her part. A few text messages in here. Rosie in Mount Eliza says she loves the oak leaf hydrangeas and finds them easier to grow in the heat of summer. I was surprised to find they're not as popular in the UK, but maybe their climate copes better, i.e. much more rain.
So, yeah, I think if you're living in England, you just have, you know,
mop tops
everywhere. and that was sort of certainly one of the places in Europe where the early breeders were.
Yep.
Were playing with the Heidis. So, yeah, a lot of those mop-top hybrids, that's where France and Germany and Britain were where they started.
Yep.
But, yeah, the oak leaves for us are just amazing. Paniculatas, oak leaves.
Yep.
The arborescence, the Annabelle's still worth having, even though it's quite an ugly bush. But, they're much better suited to our conditions as far as watering and where you can plant them and, you know, how tough they are once they're established.
Yeah. Very good. And speaking of things that go with hydrangeas, this next message here from Ida, she has three cerces in her garden, which would look particularly special with hydrangeas. Two are burgundy colour and one is the green form. These ones have seed pods on it, and I'm finding around these seedlings that look like cerceus leaves. What should I do? I don't want to end up with a whole forest of cerceus. So it sounds like the green ones have
Is it Siliquastrum, the cerceus Siliquastrum, I think? I've grown that from seed several times. So that's got a very big heart-shaped green leaf. They're legumes, so they have little tiny pea flowers that grow on the stems, and then they get these little bean pods hanging off them later. Cerces are beautiful trees. The purple leaf one's probably Forest Pansy, which I don't think...
I've never seen that one self-seed.
Mine have never really flowered that well either. Not as well as...
Ours flower really well.
Yeah, my parents both have got one.
Like either side of our front gate.
Oh, pretty.
And we have this beautiful white gate.
Yeah. Do you ever get seed pods on them?
No, I've never seen them.
But I wonder if they might be sterile maybe, being a hybrid.
Geez, when it flowers, it's just a massive pink.
They're so pretty.
So I've got a Cerceus Siliquastrum in my backyard that I grew from seed about 20 years ago.
Okay.
And so it's quite a big tree now. I haven't noticed any seedlings pop up, but I know when I first got those seeds, I can't remember where I got the seeds from, they germinated quite easily. If you've got the right conditions, they're going to grow. They'd be easy to pull out, I'm assuming. And they're probably nice plants to give to your plant friends because they're beautiful little trees.
And you can keep them pruned down too, so if they start getting too big.
Bonsai them, you can do all sorts of... Actually, the cerces really don't mind a hard prune. They're if you hack into them, they come back with a lot of vigour,
Good work. They'd look particularly special with some of those hydrangeas we've just been talking about. Another text message in Frank and Friends group in Noble Park. What is the flower for the month regarding Christmas, not poinsettia? He's wishing everyone here a Merry Christmas. Oh, I wonder what he's referring to. Christmas lily?
Hydrangeas.
Hydrangeas, yeah. We're making hydrangea the new Christmas flower.
There's a lot flowering.
Red kangaroo paws. What else is flowering now? Yeah, I'm not sure what you particularly mean there, thanks for
I've got heaps flaring wishes. At the moment. So, yeah, I bet I think if you're referring to something like the New South Wales Christmas bells or
Christmas
Yeah, the Christmas bush is the other one.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's heaps of plants that's sort of flaring around that sort of time of year.
Yeah. I like the way that, you know, we've got a variety of things in flower that we can call Christmas plants as opposed to those in the northern hemisphere, which, you know, are cold or stark or...
Yes. Holly leaves with some red berries.
Yeah. Well, that's the other one, yeah.
Oh, goodness. Greg, I keep getting your names mixed up. My goodness me. The reason why my voice is all croaky as well, I had a late night dinner with my girlfriends and, you know, we haven't seen each other in ages and so we literally talked nonstop for 5 hours. So I didn't get home until midnight, got up at 5 o'clock, so excuse the croaky voice. Ben, do you want to talk to us about some of the plants you've brought in?
Well, I think you've gone to one extreme to another. Like we've gone to these big flower hydrangeas.
I know.
I've gone to these nice delicate little flowers.
You are.
They're better anyway, the little stuff, I reckon.
I'm gonna especially look on that.
Yeah. Can we start with this little red one because it's very Christmassy?
Well, that's actually a pelargonium. So that's actually a cross between two species. One was called Pelargonium labatum and Pelargonium phlegeton. And they've actually come up with this particular variety called Pelargonium crossardens. So it's only small, only probably gets to probably around about nearly sort of 50, 60 centimetres in height. That's flowering.
Yeah.
But the flower is like this bright red, like really sort of iridescent sort of bright red flower. But then you have these burgundy sort of markings on the inside of it.
It looks so, velvet almost. Velvet-y.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I've got a couple of forms of it actually. So there's this form here, which is pretty well just what was actually bred, which is a medium sort of size flower, but also have another variety which the flower is actually twice the size of it. So the flower of this one is probably only around the size of maybe a 10-cent piece, but my other variety, the flower is about the size of a 20-cent piece. So, and then I've got another variety of the Ardens, which is an offspurt off this one here, where instead of being burgundy markings on the centre, they're actually black.
Ooh.
Really big black sort of
I was just looking at because the more open ones on that are sort of facing me on the table here, they almost look black in this light anyway.
Yeah.
And I thought that the colour combination, you know, you've got this black sort of centre in the petal and then it's a brighter red around the edge. It looks stunning, yeah.
But it's funny because, like, when it sets seed, and if I propagate it from seed, it never go back to being an Arden. So it reverts back to either phlegeton, which is actually a red form. This is where it gets its red from. It's actually from phlegeton. But the leaf shape actually comes from labatum. So it'll actually either revert to one of those different species. So it never actually reverts back to as labatum.
Okay.
So the only way I can get labatums is actually through cuttings.
Hmm.
So to keep it sort of true. But because I'm getting that variant in the sort of size and even colouring in the actual flower, I can, sort of target what I want to sort of do.
Very pretty.
Yeah, so it's nice to have that sort of variant with it. But look, they're hardy little plants. So, like, you get a mass of these big sort of that umbrella sort of shape flowers with these big red flowers on it. But instead of just having, like, you know, one stalk with, you know, three or four flowers on it, when it's matured, you'll have, like, maybe 30, 40, even up to nearly 50 flower spikes. So it's just a mass of red over the plant.
And because of that long stem, they dance.
They do, yeah. So it moves around, yeah. So,
pretty.
Because at the moment I have the phlegeton that's actually on our front veranda, or front steps as we walk up to the veranda in a big pot. And you can just see it's just a mass of that sort of orangey red sort of flower, because that's where it, you know, produces so many different flower spikes on it. So, but another particular plant I brought in was the aconitum. So monk's hood. So everyone knows the purple monk's hood. And we're actually growing a few different species, a few different varieties. So the one I actually brought in is actually a yellow form. So this is actually, you know, it grows the same sort of height as normal aconitum, but just a smaller flower. It's one of those flowers that's in the same family as your delphiniums.
Mm.
So you have that delphinium sort of shape.
Mm. I was actually wondering if it was a delphinium because I wasn't expecting it to be.
Yeah, but when you look at the actual top of the actual flower, it's like a what's those, like a gnome's hat sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's sort of quite unique. But these are a really
like
nice.
A monk's hood even.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. The monkswood.
Yeah.
So, but it's that soft yellow. It's not a real deep yellow.
Yeah.
So it's not sort of really in your face or anything. So, but getting a decent cluster of it, it's actually quite nice. So it probably only gets to about sort of maybe 70, 80 centimetres in height. That's in flower in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of slowly just multiplies in these little clumps.
They've got nice leaves too, haven't they, the monkswoods and
they do, delphiniums. Yeah.
They have that sort of nice cut, sort of almost like a maple leaf a little bit sometimes, some of the cut leaf maples, yeah.
Yeah, they are, but very poisonous too.
Yes.
Yes.
So, yeah. I mean, all the aconitums and delphiniums and foxgloves, I mean, they're all very deadly plants. Yeah,
don't eat anything
just don't eat it.
That's called bane.
Yeah, exactly.
It's probably it's got that in the name.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's like don't feed, if you've got chooks and all that sort of stuff, you just don't feed it to your chooks or let your chooks near them sort of thing because it will, not end very well.
Yes.
So, but we also grow, we got a couple of other varieties. Like we have the pure white one and we do actually have a new one, which is white with blue sort of markings all through the flower as well. And they're big flowers. So, so they're quite stunning when they're actually sort of flowering. You sort of need to have them to one side so you sort of some more appreciate them a bit more. You don't want to lose them in other plants. So where this particular one, I think if you got it in amongst other plants, it's sort of, you just, as you're walking past it, you will just notice it just sort of moving around and then you can sort of focus in on it.
Pretty.
So,
Another question about hydrangeas. There's a theme going on here, guys. Ruth from Bentley, question about hydrangea. Which one has the foliage colour changes? Are they easy to purchase? Is she referring to the oak leaf?
Because we were talking about the holding on to the colour. Yeah. The colour changes. So most of the oak leaves have nice colour foliage in autumn. I would say that the snowflake, which is pretty easy to get, I think it's quite readily available.
I've definitely seen them around very easily.
I only propagate them myself, so I think I bought one at the start and then I've created about 10,000 of them over the years. As far as colour change goes, I think they're the better ones of the oak leaves. So they just seem to hang on to their leaves a little bit better. Yep. They're a very compact bush as well. If you give them plenty of light, the species Quercifolia can be a bit more leggier and it can get quite tall as well and then sort of arch over and it's like this spreading clumping plant really if you just let it go in an area. Where the snowflake seems to be a bit shorter and a bit more compact, more foliage, more dense. They hold on to that the leaves a lot longer too, it seems, and get stronger colours. So you get these deep burgundies and reds and whatever.
In the leaves, yeah.
But the gold leaf variety is nice too.
It is. It's not quite as strong a growing, I don't think.
It's not, no. Yeah. No.
But once I've finally got one growing at Forest Glade in a little spot. I noticed it the other day, there's a little patch of gold. And it's this beautiful sort of like lemon gold yellow sort of foliage on it too. And as you say, it's a really pretty little plant. I'm not sure what the autumn colour does on that one particularly though.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Yeah.
I think it still gets that sort of discolouring of the burgundies and that through it. But, you know, I think it'll tend to lose its foliage quicker. But just I think that nice gold colour throughout the year.
I'm trying to remember what it's called.
Yeah.
I know there's one called Little Honey, which is like a stunted sort of Quercifolia. I can't remember what the gold leafed one's called though.
No, because you don't normally see it.
Yeah, it's a bit
around.
Harder,
it is harder to find.
Harder to find. So
I know there's David at Jindavik. He's got it at Jindavik Rare Plants. I think Stephen Ryan will have it.
Little Honey.
Yeah.
Little Honey. That's it. Yeah.
Little Honey.
And Craig Wilson might be worth a
shot.
Yeah, too.
Craig. Yeah. And even Yamina. Peter Teese. Yeah. So.
And the standard oak leaf, the snowflake. A quick search. It was at White House Nursery, Digger's Nursery. I've seen it at my local Mitre 10 Garden Centre.
Starting to get a bit more traction now, but for many years, you just didn't really see it around, and it's such a good doer. It's such a great hydrangea. Does pretty much everything.
You watch, nurseries are going to be selling out everywhere. any recommendations? Someone texts in for finding hydrangea Seemannii.
Stephen. That's right. The only, again, I'd go, the nurseries we just mentioned a minute ago, I'd try all of those.
Yep.
I got mine when I was about 15 off Stephen. I don't know if he still grows it.
So just the other day.
Yeah. So that Seemannii is a Mexican climbing hydrangea. So it's one that'll sort of clamber up, has aerial roots. And as far as I'm aware, I think it's only one of two species where they actually have so the petals on the flower are actually petals and not sepals because they have a bud. So the Seemannii and Involucrata have flower buds. So the baby ones are inside a bud like a rose.
Yep.
And then the buds open up and the inflorescence comes forth, and Seemannii is one of the two species.
But I think when we said Craig Wilson, it's Gentiana Nursery.
Yes.
So yeah. Yep. So that's and then you got Pedetes from Yamina.
Yes.
So yep. if you're in around the city or in the Dandenongs or the eastern sort of suburbs sort of the area.
Yeah.
If you can't get to Stevens. So,
yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, try all of those for Seemannii as well. I think would be the best place.
Does it need a strong climbing structure, or will it just like stick itself to a wall?
It has got aerial roots from memory.
Okay.
So hydrangea. Anomala, I think it is, that the Petiolaris anomala is the normal climbing hydrangea, which has aerial roots like ivy does, sort of, not quite as vigorous, but it does have little aerial roots. I'm pretty sure Seemannii does as well. I only grew it once when I was, again, like 15, 16, 17, and when Mum and Dad sold their house and I moved out, I gave it to my sister. And I'm not sure if it's still there. Okay. So I haven't grown it for 20-something years.
Yeah. Might be a nice one to go up like the east side of a house or up a fence or something.
As I say, I'm not even sure how big or vigorous they are. So if you want a climbing hydrangea, you've got the Petiolaris, which is the more common one.
Yep.
There's also the what used to be Schizophragmas, which are now, I think, hydrangeas. It's been lumped in with the genus.
Yep.
I would go those. Out of all the climbing hydrangeas, I think the Schizophragma, the ones that used to be Schizophragma, are the best ones. There's one called Moonbeam, which has a slightly variegated leaf. I'm just trying to remember. There was three species, and I'm trying to remember which species that was.
I'm just having a look for you.
Yeah. Anyway, there's Integrifolia, which has these massive big flowers, but there's nothing. It's poor aesthetically. It's sort of a bit big and bulky, and the smaller Schizophragma, which I know the hybrid's called Moonbeam. I can't think of the species name though.
Hydrangeanoides.
Yeah, that's it. Which it wouldn't have now, because now then it would be hydrangeoides.
Yeah, that's a mouthful.
So I'm not sure if that's.
Well, no, it still says that. Hydrangeoides.
It's kept its species name. If you want a climbing Heidi, I reckon that's the best one.
Oh.
So the what used to be Schizophragma hydrangeoides.
Yeah.
They're the best ones to select from if you want a climbing Heidi. They've got smaller, prettier flowers, and the foliage on them's much better, especially that Moonbeam. It's sort of a dark green heart-shaped leaf.
Yep.
And then it's got this silver, it's not really variegated, it's like a silver flush across the leaf a little bit. It's a very pretty plant. It's the prettiest of them. And it's got aerial roots. It'll grow up a concrete tank. It'll grow up a wooden fence. It'll grow up a tree trunk. It's quite useful.
I was trying to find a photo quickly while it's not loading. The last time I saw a beautiful climbing hydrangea was at Blarney Castle in Ireland. It's not rendered properly, but I'm showing a photo and it's literally a climbing hydrangea going up the side of Blarney Castle in Ireland.
Oh, wow.
It was beautiful.
Yeah.
So, you know, this big hydrangea, it was just about to burst into bloom.
There's also, I've just noticed recently too, a new hybrid hydrangea, which I think's been bred from the Macrophylla hybrids, that it hasn't got aerial roots. It's a rambling hydrangea.
Okay.
And it's called, I can't remember what that's called now too. It's under a copyright sort of thing.
So rambling, it'd be good under deciduous trees, like it'd ramble on the ground?
I would say it would ramble on the ground, or you could grow it up trellis,
which
is how they're marketing it and selling it. It's called Wedding Day or I don't know. It's got beautiful little pure white lace cap flowers, very tiny little leaves. Everything about it's macrophylla-ish.
Okay.
But it doesn't, like if you just stuck it in a pot and left it there, it'd weep over the side of the pot and go down on the ground.
Oh, wow.
It's got no structural integrity at all. It's
wedding gown hydrangea, is that
maybe.
It?
Maybe. I thought it was wedding day or something.
It doesn't
like
say
that.
It's.
I can't remember.
That's, no, it says it's a bush.
But it is out there, and they're very expensive. I think for an 8-inch pot, and a friend bought one for $120 in an 8-inch pot.
There you go. That's why you don't see much of it around, so yeah.
Oh, my goodness. If anyone has just tuned in, you are listening to the 3CR Gardening Show. My name is Chloe Thompson, and in the studio with me today is Greg Balderston and Ben Brooker. Just because the producer's studio has gone a smidge quiet, I thought I would let you know that I, as the editor of Organic Gardener magazine, have three issues I would love to give away to some callers who would like to call in. I would ask that if you have had a free issue before, please don't call again. Let someone have an issue who's not had one before. But I have in my hands issue number 162, which is our summer issue, and it's in store this week coming. So from Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday this week, you should be able to find it. It's got vibrant purple eggplants on the cover, photographed by the lovely Connie Cow, who you might have heard on 3CR before. And there's loads of things in this issue to help you in your summer garden. Tips on how to grow eggplants, tips on how to harvest herbs, hatching chickens using broody hens, natives for small spaces, and the works, even pruning, summer pruning that you should get done now as well. So you can find that at your local news agency or some supermarkets as well. So I've got three issues of that to give away if you'd like to call in, and we'll have them posted out to you. Runaway Bride Hydrangea.
That might be
there
it.
There we go. That's it. Yep. No, that is it. Hence the name Runaway.
Yeah. Yeah.
There
it's quite a pretty little, very covered in flowers.
I feel like it's a PMA one.
Yeah.
PMA plant.
Yeah. It's got.
Yeah. The PBR on it. Yep. Yeah. That does sound pretty, doesn't it? Absolutely gorgeous. We have about another 20 minutes left of the show. So there is still time to call in or text message. If you would like to talk to us on air, you can give us a call on 94190155. Likewise, if you would like one of those issues of Organic Gardener magazine, you can use that line. Or you can send us a text message on 0488 809 855. And we're here chatting plants and ready to answer any gardening questions. Ben, I have to ask you about the one with the little button yellow flowers. What's that?
That's actually it's called Cochlea hispidea. So it's in the Asteraceae family, but it's the foliage is so sort of
lovely.
Like,
I
can't see the foliage. Can
it's
you
really
hold it
sort of. There we go. It's really fluffy and soft.
Oh, it's so cute.
One of those plants that you, when you see it, you've got to touch it. Everyone touches it. But these little sort of really fine sort of stems that probably about, I think most they get is around about 15, 20 centimetres.
Yeah.
And there's this little tiny little button yellow. Mm. It's in, as I said, it's in the Asteraceae family.
It's quite closely related to the billy buttons, I think, the native ones. Because I think, is that a New Zealand species?
No, that's actually from South Africa, that
South
one.
South Africa.
Yeah, so it's actually the real southern part of South Africa. Mm. So you sort of, when you look at it, you think, oh, this really delicate plant. You have to keep it watered and keep it, you know, morning sun, afternoon shade. But it's extremely hardy.
Yeah,
it's this nice low little ground cover that sort of hugs the ground. But then these really sort of soft, delicate, sort of fairy like sort of foliage. But even a bit of dew in the morning, it sort of it builds up to these little droplets.
Yeah, it's a desert, pretty much like a desert plant. When you see those silvery leaves with the hair, and it can just suck moisture out of the air and feed
that's
itself.
What it does. Yeah, it actually sucks the moisture in, and then that's how it gets its moisture.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It's one of the most hardiest plants you'd think. It's on how delicate it actually
exactly.
Really
it looks. Like, do you know what it looks like? It looks like someone's tip pruned a woolly bush. And shoved the tip prunings into a small pot and then got miniature versions of billy buttons and poked those into that.
Yeah, on tiny little needle-like sort of stems sort of thing. Yeah, so, but yeah, and there is other versions of it as well which have bigger foliage, bigger flowers, a lot more bigger growing, robust growing.
What was its name again?
It's called Cochlea. Mm-hmm. So, Cochlea hispidea. Yeah, and there's, like I said, there's different varieties out there as well. I mean, we have another variety called Sirica, much bigger leaf, much bigger flower, and it will tend to take off on the ground as well. And if the conditions are right, it will self-layer and keep growing, where this one just sort of confines itself to probably an area around about maybe a metre at the most.
It's a great rock garden plant.
Yeah, exactly.
You can grow it with smaller bulbs and things in a little rock garden or...
Well, they pop straight through it.
Yeah.
We have got it where the Fritillaria imperialis, and that just pops straight through it. So, and that also will keep the bulb cooler as well. Yeah.
Living
as
mulch.
As you say, you don't want bare, bare dirt, although some bulbs can live in bare dirt. But, yeah, it's that thing of having the living mulch there and not having a the only downside with them sometimes is that if they're in a spot, you've got to keep other things – like bulbs are okay because they'll die down, but you don't. It's if you get like couch grass running through it, it's a nightmare because it's really hard to pull out without pulling the actual plant out. So making sure you've got a clean space to plant it in, you know, with some friends around it that aren't going to, you know, grow over it and grow through it and sort of transfer.
And I think you've got to be careful if you actually have got bulbs growing through it. That, like, for instance, like daffodils, I mean, their foliage, as they're dying down, they'll just cover it and then it'll kill it off that way. But so I think that's what I like about the Fritillaria, because it's more upright and it's not really dense.
Yep.
And it's just that singular sort of bulb, even though it does produce little bulblets, but I usually pull them out and scatter them through the garden. But,
It's a gorgeous little plant.
Very sweet.
It's certainly one that when we do take it to expos, I'll watch people, and as soon as they see it, they've got to touch it. and Kerry's got a beautiful story as well. We did one expo, this is years ago, and this lady, she had a blind child, and she's walking around, and I think she asked Kerry what plants, you know, could she use for a child. So Kerry picked this plant up and took it over to her, and I think as soon as I touched it, they just smiled, and you could see this sort of this beauty of sort of excitement coming through. It's something that it's always been memorable for Kerry, and one of the most rewarding sort of things that she's ever done in this industry. So just to sort of supplying something like that to someone and giving them so much joy just through touch.
Because it is so soft. It's literally like a cat.
It is. It's so soft, So
beautiful. Love that. Heads up, folks. All those magazines have gone. Lots of lovely messages and Merry Christmases from everybody. So thank you so much for that. And if you missed out on a free one, you can pick one up in store this week. And I love hearing readers' feedback. So you're welcome to shoot me a DM on social media via the Organic Gardener Instagram or my own Instagram, Been There, Dug That. We love hearing from readers how they like the changes to the mag that we've made and, you know, any story ideas that they might have. And also I'd encourage any horticulturists or professionals out there who would like to, you know, dabble in writing, or maybe they have some articles that they'd like to share with me, feel free to shoot me an email with some pictures or with some ideas, or just let me know that you're interested in writing. I'd love to hear from you. Runaway Bride was the PMA plant 2025. There we go. I knew it was in my head for a reason. I'd seen the media releases. Sally says, many thanks. Love hearing about caring for our soils. Ben's information is so helpful and informative. Can he keep us updated about his upcoming events? Oh, I'm sure he will.
We're still going to do a lot more sort of organising. Craig and I are still going to talk more about it. It was something that was thrown around after the event. And I think we've sort of both agreed, because the effort that Kerry put into to get the first one to happen was a lot of work. And Kerry, she did such a marvellous job sort of getting it, pulling it all together, organising, you know, people to have stalls there, and just the, I don't know, the advertisement of it all. I mean, it was just so much work. So, and that was one of the conditions is, as I said to Kerry, if I do this again, that, you know, that Craig and myself and Paul, we need to take on more of a role to, you know, to do it together. So it's not so strainful on just on one person. So
Good idea.
But it was a fantastic day, and it was just inspiring, and I think it was more also inspiring to the people that went and paid to go there, but it was also inspiring for myself and Craig it sort of made us sort of realise that, you know, what we actually talk about, people are actually taking this on board because there's so much science and so much information that's it's out there that's just not been released.
Yeah.
So, and we're sort of, what's what we're trying to do? We're trying to get that information out there so, and people to look at how we can do things differently and better.
Yeah. Well, and having, you know, in-person, hands-on events, see, people can see demonstrations, as you said, listen to people in real life. You know, it's almost like people are a little – people don't want webinars at the moment. We had all of that and we, you know, shudder at the COVID thought. So I love that people are enjoying.
Well, there's two different ways of people learning. And some most people, it can be through visual. Some people can listen to something or read something and then, and they've, you know, they've – they can retain that information.
Yeah.
Some people need to sort of visually see things.
Yeah.
So, and I think when you talk about particular, excuse me, things like how root exudates work in an actual plant, like if we actually dug a plant up and showed you these different sort of mechanisms on what these plants can do, when you visually see those things, then it goes, oh, yeah, look, it makes sense. So where if I talk about it and don't have an illustration there, people will be trying to put that illustration in their mind and it can be completely different, but it just doesn't make sense for them. So I think if we have those sort of type of workshops, I think people can sort of retain that information and put things together a lot better.
Yeah, very true. I find I'm one of those people that likes a visual description or a visual explanation, but that I also learn a lot more from the actual doing process. You know, so someone can show me a cutting demo, but then if I do it quite soon afterwards, you know, and maybe fail or maybe, you know, stuff something up or that's when I tend to learn.
I think by doing it too, you also get better at knowing what to ask or what to listen to or what part you need to listen to get the full scene of it. So once you've you listen once, you go and do it or you put it into action or whatever and then you go, oh, that didn't work, but now I know why it didn't work so I can go back again and learn the bit that I missed the first time, which,
Well, and it's that also having a bit more understanding, you could actually, instead of asking the question, you could try something a little bit differently that you think of that actually works for you. So because one way is always not necessary.
Very rarely is there one way to do everything, is it?
So there's always that other way. It's just a matter of how you're sort of interpreting it and sort of using that information sort of, to get across or to produce what you want to do. So
That's the joy of gardening, the flexibility and the experimentation, isn't it?
Because you think about it, plants don't read books.
No, they don't.
They don't read books. So there's no rule in horticulture. You've just got to, I think, if you listen to the people that have experienced it and take on what they actually do, and then you take that on and then do that yourself, that's the best way
to learn. As you say, it's almost like there's laws, not rules. As in you can, the laws guide you on how to, like the natural laws guide you on how to do something, but there's no fixed and fast rule. There's no rule on you have to do it this way.
But that is nature's law.
Exactly.
The other terminology is that explicate order to implicate order. Explicate is what you see is what you get. The implicate is what's actually happening underneath. So that's those two laws. I think they're very fundamental. I think sort of principles that if you do those and incorporate those into your gardening sort of, you know, sort of processes, it's like, I don't know, you sort of have that more connection with the with your garden or with the particular plants that you're actually working with, and then doing different things in different ways that even though you've seen it do been done another one way and then you do it in a different sort of format way, but they both work together. Yeah, because you're working in that sort of nature's law or that explicate and implicate sort of,
We've had a message in from Susie. There are contact details for Dr. Greg Moore on the Melbourne University website. Google his name and select UniMelb to find an expert option.
Wasn't it University of Melbourne they were talking about? The person that called in was talking about the...
She was working there. Well, no, she's actually talking about the Parkville campus because I went to Parkville for my undergrad, so I can picture exactly where she's talking about. Right. She's talking about one of the student
accommodations. That might be a good thing if Greg's working
for... Would be.
For University of Melbourne.
Yeah, and that's at least they're connected. Yeah. And I mean, I'm fairly sure he used to come up to Parkville sometimes for lectures, so I'd say he knows the campus. So.
Oh, hopefully he's available for it, because as I say, he's the best expert on that, I would think.
Yeah.
Or one of them.
Yeah, for sure. Listeners might have noticed as well that I haven't read out any events or, you know, so forth like we normally do. It's because we haven't got any. So,
it's Christmas.
It's Christmas, exactly. That's our event. Go out and enjoy your garden. Pull up a picnic rug and sit on your own lawn or on a, you know, on a deck chair out amongst your flowers or under a tree.
I think probably the only really events would be is Open Gardens Victoria. They'd probably have some gardens.
Definitely throughout January they would. So. Definitely check those out over January.
Forest Glades open.
There you go. When's that?
Every day.
Oh, every day.
Except for maybe Christmas Day and Total Fire Bands, but yeah, that's pretty much open every day.
There you go.
So there's an event.
There's an event. Mm. Nice work.
It's just a very common one.
No. Well, it's not that common if people haven't been. No. So, yeah.
But then, like, open gardens, I mean, like, the gardens, because we're sort of a bit of a later season, like, we went up to Cloud Hill just recently. Went with Virginia, and we just looked through their perennial border, and it's looking beautiful.
Yeah,
I mean, even our garden at the moment is starting to really, really sort of show a lot of colour.
It's a weird season. Like, there's still rhodies and Mollis azaleas flowering up at Forest Glade, and like usually the herbaceous peonies are done by, you know, by the end of November they're completely done.
Yeah,
and they're just starting to flower, some of them.
Oh.
It's a very strange season up there. Very cold season. I see queen European wasps flying around the last couple of days, which is strange. Like, they're almost, you're almost ready to see the drones at this time of the year. And I've seen queens looking for nesting sites the last couple of weeks. Quite a few of them.
Yeah.
It's a really weird, confused season.
It is a bit. I feel like my dahlias are bigger at this time of the year than they've ever been. They've got flower buds that are about to open, but they're huge compared to what they normally would be at this time of the year. So they're early.
Yeah.
Whereas things are late.
Well, it's almost at a point where it's like, are they early or late?
Yeah.
I've seen Amanita muscaria mushrooms.
Okay.
Which are they're mycorrhizal mushrooms, and they're quite set on when they do their thing.
Yeah.
And it's not now. It's
I've
in
had
autumn.
A lot of mushrooms.
6 months off. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So field mushrooms and things like that, if it's wet and humid, they'll pop up, you know, especially the things like field mushrooms and saprotrophs, you know, the recycling mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
But the mycorrhizal mushrooms, they're very much like, this is our thing. We do it now.
Yeah.
And that's when they do it. And, you see saffron milk caps and Amanita muscaria popping up in November, December. That's literally the opposite end of the season when they should be doing it. Yeah. Very strange.
Very strange indeed. We've run out of time to talk about more of your beautiful plants there, Ben. But you've got your... Do you have your online shop? No,
we don't do online.
You don't do
we
online.
We only do the expos. So our next one won't be until in autumn.
March?
Yeah.
What would you do in March?
Yeah, in March. So there is Ferny Creek. There's Jindavik.
Yep.
Yeah. So Yarra Valley, sadly, is not doing it this year, autumn plant fair, but they will do the following one. It'll go back to normal later.
Right.
So, So, because it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
To sort of organise, these events.
Mm.
So, and I think it was, something that they had to do, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's only for this next autumn, that's it. After that, they would go back to normal.
Right,
So there is a couple of plant fairs then after that, spring.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. I know. It's funny. It sort of goes through a bit of a lull now, and then March turns into what I call Mad March, and, you know, then it all starts all over again.
Yeah, it's too hot.
Yeah,
you know, over summer. So I mean, a lot of our plants, I mean, they like in pots because the pots can reach sort of high temperatures and that. So they don't look very good. And there's no way in the world I'd take them out.
Anyway. When I had the nursery, I did farmers markets every weekend.
Yeah,
and then plant fairs whenever they were on. But the farmers markets every weekend. A lot of them two farmers markets in a weekend. And summer was just the worst because no one wanted to buy anything when it's 35 degrees.
No.
Yeah. So, putting a plant fair on would be a lot of stress for the owner, for the nursery,
yeah.
the nursery people that are going. People just aren't really interested in planting something in the middle of, or you're looking after a pot, or, you know, planting something in the middle of summer. So,
yeah,
It's not the best time for that sort of event,
no,
unfortunately.
But, you know, get out and enjoy your garden in other ways. I'm just checking if I didn't miss a text message. I don't think I did. No, I don't think I did. Is there anything else you needed to add, or you wanted to add before we round up the show soon?
But I think you get out to open gardens, or get out to gardens, because they are looking really nice at the moment.
That was literally one of my husband's wish lists for this summer holidays. We've got to go to one of the diggers' gardens.
Yeah.
That's you know, he's not a gardener, but he loves them. He's the grunt, he says, because, you know, I'm like, dig there. Put that there. But, you know, he loves them.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think so many of the open gardens are perfect. Yes, hi, Trixie. Are perfect even for people who aren't necessarily a gardener.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've got a partner who's not necessarily as plant nerdy as you, they'll still enjoy them.
Yeah, just a nice beautiful day. Yeah,
exactly.
Get out amongst the plants and that.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, like, we've got our echinaceas. What's Echinacea pallida, and also Echinacea paradoxa, which is it's very similar to pallida, but it's yellow.
Mm.
Pallida's that sort of really, still has that cone, but the petals on it are really fine and they really droop down. It's sort of like that ballerina sort of type of plant, flower actually. Just the amount of flowers I've got coming out on that and the height of it, it's just, I think because we had that cooler sort of start, and we've had that little bit of moisture, they've just really sort of bursted it and taken off, and now that heat is bringing the flowers out now. So,
you've just reminded me too, in the Japanese garden at Forest Glade, I've been planting out woodland perennials, like rarer ones, Podophyllums and Dicentra, and I bought some primula seeds off Merrill a couple of years ago and grew them from seed, not knowing what most of them were. And I've got three Primula Viallii, which I've had it before and killed it, but these ones I grew from seed and they're flowering. But all these Primulas I never knew existed, and the most stunning colour range, all from seed, you know, bright orange ones, and then there's one species that have multiple, like each plant came out a different colour, and they're soft pastels, like purpley pastel and like a butter, sort of soft pastel butter colours, and then the Viallii, which is sort of like a red hot poker of the Primula world. It's got these quite pointy, the individual flowers are tiny, but they're in like a spike, and they come out purple, but the buds are red. So it's like this red spike with these purple flowers around the base.
You get that powdery sort of on the stems and the leaf. Yeah,
that's looking, yeah, all those perennials. You know, there's a Paris quadrophylla coming up and
it's just flowering
everywhere, and Arisema's just finishing, and all this stuff that I've been packing in there the last couple of years just came to life this year.
It sounds like if you are going to open gardens or to Forest Glade, make sure your phone is fully charged for lots of photos.
For the photos, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're coming to the end of the show, folks, so I thought I'd take a moment to give a big thank you to our producers today, Bern Lamberg and Pierre Lefebvre. Thank you so much, ladies. Big thank you to Daniel Jackson and Liam Killick for doing our social media, and we will take some photos of the plants that we've spoken about today and pop them up on our socials. A big thank you, of course, to you, our listeners, for tuning into the 3CR Gardening Show. If you are listening to this as the podcast, we'd love it if you could give us a rating and a review on whatever platform you're listening from. And that's pretty much it from us now. So my name's Chloe Thompson. It has been absolutely amazing chatting gardening with you all. I will let you head off and enjoy your Sunday out in the garden. And we will chat to you next time here on the 3CR Gardening Show. So thank you so much, folks. See you later.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.